Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm the host of the podcast, Cindy House, if we haven't met before. So nice to meet you. Thanks for being here. Before we get into talking about Hannah Reid, let's talk about how we can become better acquainted with each other. You can sign up for Basic Folk's monthly newsletter at our website, which is basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We are a listener-supported operation, and you can make a contribution by going to our website. If you give at least $5 a month or $60 for the entire year, you'll gain access to Basic Folk's bonus episodes called Backstage, and there is a link in the show notes to help support Basic Folk. You can go to basicfolk.com/donate. I have been wanting to talk to Scotland-born fiddler and current New Yorker Hannah Reid on the pod for longer than Basic Folk has existed. I met her at the very fun camp Miles of Music in New Hampshire, where we laughed our faces off all week, and I was truly blown out of the water by her fiddling and singing. She's just released a new duo album with the Scottish banjo player Michael Starkey, so it seemed like a good time to get Hannah on. She grew up in Edinburgh as well as on the Isle of Eigg, which is a remote island off the western coast of Scotland, and she talks about how living simply as a younger person has impacted her adulthood. Growing up, there was a lot of music in the house in terms of listening to and playing music. Her mom played cello, her sister played fiddle, and there was also a community of musicians on the island playing that she connected very deeply with. She started playing Scottish traditional music at the age of 6 and cites her biggest influences as the musicians surrounding the trad scene in Scotland. She made her way to America to attend Berklee College of Music in Boston and eventually moved to Brooklyn. Her new album with Michael, Cross the Rolling Water, is filled with old-time fiddle and banjo duets with the Edinburgh-based musician Michael Starkey. The two met at an Appalachian old-time session in Edinburgh in late 2019. She talks about their musical relationship, as well as how Michael only has a flip phone, which is always hilarious to hear about from someone who's like basically on top of technology. Hannah's hilarious, kind, and has an infectious energy that carries from her personality to her music. Before we get into our conversation with Hannah, let's check out a song from her 2018 solo album, Way Out I'll Wander. This is the opening track, Moorland Bear. And then we'll get to our conversation with Hannah Reid on Basic Folk.
A lover of a moorland bear and honest country winds you were. The silver skimming rain you took and love the floodings of the brook. Frost mountains, fire and seas, tumultuary silences, winds in darkness, five to tune, in the high riding virgin moon.
Hannah Reid, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's so nice to see you.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Cindy.
Okay, we're going to be covering a lot of ground today. Are you ready for it?
I hope so.
Yeah. I'm not going to bring up hip-hop Hannah, just in case you were...
I wondered if hip-hop Hannah was going to come right to the surface after our last chat.
So you grew up in Edinburgh on the Isle of Eigg?
So Yeah, I was born in Edinburgh. And then when I was six, we moved off to the Isle of Egg, pronounced like
egg.
An egg. Yeah, E-I-G-G, like an egg.
Okay.
And lived there for a bit and then went back to Edinburgh. But
okay. So how long were you on the island for?
So we spent a full year living there. I lived with my mum and my sister in a little cottage with no electricity or running water. And it was this crazy thing that we did, moving away from Edinburgh and like the normal school, primary school system there. And we moved off and lived there full time for a year. But we were going there for like 3 months of the year, every year from when I was born. So yeah, it's kind of like, even though I grew up in Edinburgh, I did my high school in Edinburgh and mm-hmm. the majority of my schooling in Edinburgh, Edinburgh is very important to me. The egg is like very, very important as well.
Yeah, for sure. I can understand that. I grew up in like suburban Boston, but my family also has like a very rustic cabin in the Berkshires that has like no running water or electricity. So like we would spend like summer vacations there, but never lived there. So I can totally understand that. But I also like that cabin for me has like really impacted who I am and like how I deal with things. Yeah. Like being dirty is like, okay, I'm okay with like being dirty and stuff like that. So I'm wondering how the Island of Egg has impacted you in those same kind of ways.
Yeah, I mean, good question. Very good question. It's heavily impacted everything, I would say. I would say that for me, the fact that growing up, it wasn't about what TV we were watching or what, you know, what was going on currently in currently in the world as well. Like I would say we were just like off in our own zone there, out in the field playing all day long. And as far as like music is concerned, there were constantly like world-class amazing musicians coming through Egg as I was growing up. So like, you know, it would be like the word would get around that so-and-so fiddle player was coming and I was like down there like with my fiddle on my back, like ready to play tunes with whoever came off the boat. And it's just very important for me, an amazing place. I mean, it's got an amazing story as an island. And when we actually lived there, there were 9 children in the school. So we were all in one classroom with one teacher. We did Gaelic once a week. Like that was an important part of the whole Egg primary school experience. And there were 65 people living on the island when I lived there. So, you know, it's a tiny community, like really, really small. And all of us in the same classroom, just like everybody got very close and it was very safe and it was amazing. But I think there's also a part of me, and I'll get into like where I am now and what's going on, but you know, comparing, like I'm in New York right now and going from Egg to New York. And this is a question that comes up a lot. Like, how did you end up, you're in New York, but you grew up on Egg? Like, what? And they are, worlds away from each other. But I love the fact that they're so different. And everywhere I've lived has been so different from the next. And yeah.
Yeah, I should have opened with this a little bit about the Isle of Egg. It's a remote island off of the western coast of Scotland. And here's some fun facts I learned on Wikipedia today.
Oh, yeah.
It's 12 square miles. I read that the Scottish Wildlife Trust manages the island as a nature reserve. And all of the pictures are like the most dreamy pictures of Scotland you could possibly imagine. And then the estimated population in 2019 was 107 people. Mm. So the population is nearly doubled.
It's pretty incredible, right?
Yeah. You recently went to Alaska, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel parallels between Alaska and Egg?
Yeah. And that's, I think, my partner's from Alaska. So I'm up there a lot and I was up there I was playing at the Alaska Folk Fest last month. And so being up in Alaska, the people in Alaska are like it's a very similar vibe to Scotland. There's this like, to the west coast of Scotland specifically. It It's hard to explain. It's quite like rough and ready, but also just like folk are up for a grand old time, but also work really hard. And like, it's just a really, it's it, they just have a very similar vibe. Like being plonked into Alaska last summer, I was, you know, this big jam of old time musicians. And I could have, if no one had been talking and I just looked around, I could easily have just been in Scotland, like on the island, looking around at like, even just what people are wearing, what people are like, their whole vibe is very similar. And that goes for the same in Louisiana. Like, I feel it's a very similar vibe there. And like Lafayette, like in the, like, let's say like the Black Pop community down there, the Cajun scene, is there's like, there's a similar sort of essence in those three places. I'm constantly linking them up.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Black Pot is a music festival and a music camp that takes place in Louisiana. That's very fun. And I've never been, but I've seen, like, I've heard enough about it and seen enough videos and pictures to know that I'm missing out every time it happens. And I hate it.
It's, well, it's happening this year. So.
All right. All right. When you were growing up, there was lots of music around you in your house in terms of like listening to music and playing music. Mm-hmm. Your mom played cello. Your sister played fiddle. Is she an older sister?
Yeah, she's a couple of years older.
Very influential. And then you were talking about the community of musicians on the island playing. And you said, I loved how playing music made me feel as a child. There was never any question that it wasn't the right thing for me to do. Can you describe how performing music made you feel as a child and how you relate to that feeling now?
When I was little, I loved performing. I loved being in front of people with my fiddle and just like, I just loved playing tunes. I just loved it so much. And I don't know, I definitely wasn't the timid child that was hiding in the corner of the room. Let's just say, I'm sure a lot of people in Egg would be like, yeah, Hannah was always in there. And I think it was, I think for like playing, being lucky enough to play with so many older musicians when I was so little. And that goes for like going, I went to like, you know, camps and fiddle camps and music camps all over the place. And it was just like the community. It was just, that was so prominent when I was little. And I had a whole crew of young musicians around me, my age as well. Like there were these people that we were all like, they're amazing. And then, but we could all be like try and, you know, be those people together. I think if I'd been by myself trying to do that, it would have been maybe quite different, but I was just so lucky to have that. And then now I've just like seeked out community in that world forever. Does that answer that?
Totally. Yeah. When you're talking about having peers your own age, was that on the island?
There were some musicians on the island, but more actually in the Edinburgh scene. In the Edinburgh scene, like there was this thing which is kind of the equivalent of, I don't know, kids. I know it's come up many times in other episodes of yours, Valley of the Moon Festival, which I've camp in California, which I've never been to. But it's the whole generation of my age instrumentalists who were at that. I was at an equivalent called the Youth Gathering, which was in Edinburgh, which Maeve Gilchrist, I don't know if you've ever chatted to Maeve on this, but
harp.
Yeah. So Maeve and I, we met when we were about 8 in Edinburgh and became best friends through that world. And there were so many young trad players at that time. So it was mostly Edinburgh. And then in Glasgow, there was just like the central belt of Scotland was just filled with like young, there was an amazing scene actually growing up. And there was a whole like Borders fiddler. They would all come up for the fiddle festival in Edinburgh that happened every November. And it was so exciting. It was just like the most exciting thing. It was, I remember being like, gotta learn all the cool new tunes for this thing. And I think I remember that like the sweet spot for that one was when I was like 11 through 15. It was like, it was the most exciting, the last week of November. It was like, oh, here we go. Like, it was brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said your dad had like a massive record collection.
Yeah.
So what music of his was really resonating with you when you're young, and how did his musical taste help you determine your own?
So my dad had a back. So my dad didn't play any music. He grew up in South Africa, so there was a lot of African music, which he was playing all the time. And my dad's record collection was like as eclectic as it could possibly get. And that goes for like seeing live music from when I was like really young with my dad, going to see the most. The kind of shows like going to see like DJ Shadow and like Manu Chao and all this stuff and like loads of like dub reggae. Dad loved reggae, so that was like a big him and my mom met down in Bristol, which had a big reggae scene down there, and so like there was that, but then also like Bela Fleck, and he was obsessed with the Grateful Dead and Flying Burrito Brothers and all, and like Allman Brothers and all of that, that whole scene, Jerry Garcia and David Grisman. Him and a friend of his were just obsessed with bluegrass as well. So that was really what got me into that. When I was a teenager, I got just completely obsessed with Tim O'Brien and Bela Fleck and Alison Krauss and all of these people and Nickel Creek. I was just like, this is bad. it was a friend of my dad's who was like, Hannah needs to hear this music. Because there was no, at that time, people were coming and playing in the UK, but there wasn't the internet. You didn't really know, unless you were in these close, like, for example, there's this festival that happens, or music, this camp called Sore Fingers, which happens in the south of England every year. It's an old time and bluegrass camp, which when I was up in Scotland, there was no one that I knew wanting to play old time or bluegrass music at all. And so I was like, I've got to move to America. I mean, we'll get to that, I'm sure, in a little bit. But like, but that was this camp has been happening for many, many, many decades down south, but I just had no idea that it existed.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't even hear about it until I'd moved to America. So that was, there was this funny thing. It was like, yes. And yeah, so that was that. But going back to Dad's record collection, he got me into Joni Mitchell. I remember long car journeys listening to Blue when I was like 10, and it was just the best thing ever. And us singing.
What were you thinking of all those lyrics that she was saying?
To be honest, I actually, at that age, wasn't even listening to the lyrics. I would sing along with all the lyrics, but I didn't know. I wasn't really listening to it. I was just singing, like my sister and I singing along to all of the little woo. The entire record. We would just, the pair of us in the back of the car, just singing to the entire record. But also my dad traveled a lot in his life, and he spent a period of time living on Crete, the island of Crete, down in, well, he'd like basically spent quite a few nights, I believe, in the caves, in which is where Joni Mitchell did, where she, wow. and he used to like hang at the Mermaid Cafe. And so, wow. And I mean, for me, this dad would be like, oh yes, I've been to the Mermaid Cafe. So that became my like cool story when I was like, my dad's actually been to the Mermaid Cafe. I know it still exists now, but he was there. He was there in like the early 70s, late 60s. And like, I mean, who knows? Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, he was there when it was all happening there. And yeah, anyway, look, that's a little bit of a tangent, but yeah.
Did you know Anais Mitchell's parents lived I don't know what island they were living on.
I did
in
not
Greece,
know that. No.
But they like would party with Leonard Cohen.
Really?
And stuff. Maybe they partied with your dad.
Wow, that's really epic. Yeah, there's my, actually in London, my grandpa was he was a architect, but also a etcher. He was an artist, but he wasn't a musician at all, but he moved in these like cool bohemian circles in North London and would like hang out with like Sandy Denny and in these like really, and I heard all these stories like in my, you know, when I was growing up, and I just thought this was I think at the time when I first had, I'm like, yeah, whatever, cool. And now it's like, oh, Sandy Denny's like one of my number one ladies in the world, and
of course, yeah,
just the idea of my grandpa just like hanging at parties with Sandy Denny, I'm like, what?
Wow.
So yeah, Sandy Denny, Richard Thompson, there was like the whole like folk revival stuff going on in our house. There was also like loads of David Bowie, like, in a massive way. Dad was super into him, and we were always singing at the top of our lungs. Changes! Like, family car journeys were the best.
Oh, that's great. Is your dad still around?
No, my dad passed away 2 years ago. He passed away the first week of the pandemic. He had been ill for, like, 5 years, and he passed away not from COVID, but from this other thing that he had. And it was I was incredibly close with my dad, and it was a very, very difficult thing, but I feel like we had an amazing relationship and really, like, did as much as we possibly could have possibly done to this age. You know, I wasn't like, well, later on in life, Dad and I will do that. Like, we traveled a lot together, and we just talked about everything. And music was such, like, my career is kind of what, like, I mean, I've been told, like, kept him going. Like, my music and my, like, this, everything going on in my life, he got so much energy from hearing about what I was doing, what my, like, all my best friends are just incredible musicians, what everybody was doing. And he loved it so much, so much. Mm. So yeah, but Dad's, yeah. So that's been a big thing in my life, because that kind of, the few years leading up to that informed, you know, changed where I was going to live. What I was living in New York before that. And so I kind of, for 2 years, I was doing 6 weeks in the UK, 6 weeks in the US for like leading up until the pandemic. So when the pandemic actually hit, I flew back to Scotland on the 15th of March, and he passed away that next weekend. I didn't get to see him actually, but I was so glad I was over there. And also for me, I mean, I know everybody said this, but just suddenly landing, having been so all over the place, like, I hadn't had a base in, it felt like, many, many years. It was kind of, oh, and here we are, and I was back in my little cocoon with my mum. So
yeah,
it was amazing. It was amazing to get that time.
Wow, I did not know all that info. That's wow. Such a wild thing to deal with it at the beginning of such a crazy time.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And, you know, we knew it would happen. It was coming. But for us as a family, just it was a really, really, really hard time for a long time. And he had a very horrible disease, and it was very, very difficult. And we thought there was bits where we thought he would get better, but then it just, like, declined. But, you know, I'm just grateful for the time that I put in to come and see him and spend. And, like, I called him every single day and every single afternoon and when I was away. And so there's been a lot of, like, breaking these that was my routine. So now actually being back in the real world again and being back in New York and not having this thing that I would do at 3 o'clock every afternoon and not having to be responsible for something else. Like, my mom is healthy and well and amazing, and hopefully that continues for, you know, a while. But it's been very interesting to navigate the world, you know, in this very strange climate that we're in now. It's feeling more normal, but, like, it still is weird. And with all of this, like, it's like, I still, even like today, I was like, oh, shouldn't I be calling? So I just called my mom, because my mom, you know, she just got into bed. I just forget. It's also
right. What coast are you on right now?
I'm in New York.
Oh, okay.
So it's only 5 hours away. She was getting to bed.
Not too bad. So going back to, when you started playing music, so you started playing Scottish traditional music when you were six, and your biggest influences were the musicians that were surrounding you in the traditional Scottish scene. So can you set the scene for, like, what that looked like when you first started, and also how your first exposure to performing still impacts the player you are today?
So Okay, so I was playing trad music, but I also took classical lessons. So it, the first bit was actually taking classical for in Edinburgh. I was doing like group classical lessons. There were three of us in a class, and then I started taking private lessons. And I would say then I started learning by ear. The whole learning by ear thing was like critical. I loved playing. I don't know if I loved practicing as a kid. And that was a big thing. Like I really loved playing and I was always playing, but practicing, mom would be like, all right, like maybe you should like actually practice your scales. I'm like, I'm playing. I just like, I'll get there. So those first, and the first like experiences I had playing were in these groups of, it was this youth gathering thing that I was talking about before, where there were all these young people and we had these concerts, which were actually like super experimental. There was the leader of our group was called Simon Tumier, who's this incredible concertina player. Simon would teach us a tune and there would be like a couple of flutes, two or three harps, five fiddles, like two baron players, penny whistle. There would just be the whole thing. We'd all be learning all different standards, like very different standards, but we all like adapted and it wasn't really like a hierarchy or anything. And we would do these concerts, which often involved playing tunes. And then they would involve like being really experimental and improvising and keeping it really fun. And I think that fun thing and like it not having to be super serious from the get-go is something that I, to this day, like really, really try to hold on to. Like when I'm a part of a project and I'm doing it and I'm kind of questioning my involvement in it, or what is it? Is it I don't like the music? Is it the people? Is it just me? Do I not fit into? When there's a question, it's like, and it always kind of comes back to, is this fun? Am I enjoying myself right now? And like, I look back at, you know, the periods in my life where I've really enjoyed myself playing music. And that for me, actually having fun in a job or just like a setting is just way more important to me than like, than like doing something that's like a very good gig to do. You know, it's like,
right.
And no, not everybody thinks like this and life cannot always be fun, but like, I try to enjoy myself. Like I really try to enjoy myself when I can, because I mean, that's just when I'm playing music. Like, and if I do like a bunch of gigs with a band and I'm not having a really great time, and if I feel like it just isn't, I'm not the right person for the gig, like I'll flag that up, you know, because I just don't think not everybody is made for every gig. Even however much you maybe musically work, if you're feeling like, ooh, inside, that's, yeah. So
yeah. Do you also feel like a lot of that has to do with like listening to your like intuition and your gut feeling about things? I've been thinking about that a lot.
Yeah. Big lately. Time. Yeah, totally. I feel like that is, and I think this is just I've had this conversation with quite a lot of people recently, regarding work, but also relationships and questioning stuff. And because I've had my fair share of relationships, fair share of bands, fair share of things that I've been involved with that I know from the beginning it wasn't the right thing. You know, I knew that, but I was like fighting against it. And I know things, feelings can change, where you sort of slip into a situation can, it can change and you can adapt, and that's great when it works. But like the gut, I really think it's a real thing that we've got to listen
to. It's a gift, and you know, it takes a lot of work to tap into it, and it also takes a lot of work to listen to it. So let's keep trying.
I mean, my gut's not always right, let's be honest. I've definitely been involved in, I'm like, really? I had a read? But I think it's getting better as I get older.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, for sure. You're also a guitar player, but you're like, first and foremost, people know you as a fiddler. But how has being a fiddler affected your guitar work?
So my guitar playing, I started much, much later. I started guitar, actually, so I went to Berklee in Boston, and I took guitar for non-guitar principles in my very last year of college, which was pretty classic. It was actually very funny. Me and Sarah DeRose lived together at the time, and I didn't have a guitar, so I would take her like beautiful Collings guitar to my classes. And I think the teacher was just always like, well, what's your deal? You've got this like amazing guitar and you're rubbish. but anyway, that's not the part. So I always think of that funny. He would always be like, well, why? How come you have this guitar? Ooh.
You're like, oh, I live with Bonnie Raitt.
Exactly. I would say it came pretty quick to me, guitar. I'm not an amazing guitar player at all, but I think melodies, I'm a mediocre guitar player. I think I'm quite solid with what I do. But as like a side guitar player, I would very much have to learn parts. But within my own thing, my own playing is very like melodic. And I think the tunes that are constantly floating around my head, like the fiddle tunes, definitely weave themselves into my playing. So, you know, if I'm singing, I feel like between my phrases, I've also often got like some kind of fiddle-esque line that will like weave its way in. There was like a point where it kind of clicked for me, and it feels a lot if it suddenly clicked. I actually think it took like a couple of years, a bit wonky, and then it really clicked. And that was just from playing out. It wasn't from sitting in my room practicing. It was like just booking a bunch of gigs and getting on with it.
Yeah, just like you learned it because you had to.
Yeah, totally. Basically. It was, and yeah, and also like I knew that I wanted, didn't, when I first moved over here, I was very into the idea of being like a fiddle player, singer, and accompanying my vocals on fiddle. And I did that for a while. But it never felt like me. And I know so many people who do it so brilliantly. Mm. Bruce Mosky, Laura Cortese, and so many people are like incredible at it. And it was just never my thing. So I was like, right, gotta get on this guitar. Like, why have I waited till I was like 24. I was like, why did I wait so long? But you know, it is what it is.
You have been educated. Your musical education took place at first in community. Then you went to study at the City of Edinburgh Music School, the American School of Modern Music in Paris, and of course, Berklee, which is a lot of school. So where did you fall when it came to like being overly studious and academic about music versus like keeping that original kind of community vibe that you started off on growing up in Scotland?
Mm. I would say right from the get-go, like I was doing all of this training, but also I was always playing with people at the same time. At school, music was my thing. Let's just say I didn't really throw myself too hard into the academics at all. the music school, which is, I was there from 11 through 18. It was a full-time music high school, which you do all the other subjects as well. It's attached to like a normal school, but it has this amazing school. It was like this council, the council paid for it. And it was just this like incredible school. It's where Maeve went as well. And it was just like, it was amazing. We had amazing opportunities and like got to play for everybody when they'd come to town. It was just like a really cool thing. Fiddle and classical violin and piano and jazz singing, which was what I ended up doing in Paris. But like I knew that I always wanted to play fiddle. So like I was at the weekends, I was always playing fiddle music with people. I was always playing tunes. I can't say I was at home studying. And then like friends of mine who were like, yes, yeah, so I was, this and this and this on my violin and my piano growing up. And then I also got these grades and I was in math. No. I was just like, I'm sorry. I just was straight. I was either like painting in the art department or I was playing music or like trying to like, I was, I used to sit in the practice rooms and learn jazz standards and sing and play jazz standards on the piano. And those are the good old days. But then in Paris, again, it was just about, I did a jazz diploma there in jazz vocals, which was a different lifetime of me.
Yeah, seriously.
I was really, really into jazz singing for a while. I think that was, I loved all the old greats. And I also loved like Amy Winehouse and Erykah Badu and all like the crossover, you know, R&B and hip hop and all of that and that kind of crossover jazz stuff. And I think at that point I was like, I'm going to put a fiddle to the side and I'm just going to do this. So there are old school Hannah Reid EPs floating around of that stuff, which I actually do not have a copy of, but they are, I'm sure they're pretty hilarious. I still love it. I still really love all that music, but it was not really for me. And actually when I came over to Berkeley, my original scholarship was for jazz vocals. And then I got there and I was like, actually, I want to be in the string department. And so I had to wait another year and I re-auditioned and I auditioned and then I was in the string department for 4 years.
I mean, it's a good spot to be in if you're trying to get back into fiddle because the Celtic bluegrass old times community is excellent that area.
Oh, it was amazing. And it was, I mean, when I was in France, that was when I really got into listening to Crooked Still and Alison Krauss in a big way and like the Ducks and all these bands. And I was like, right, well, Crooked Still are there. And, you know, all of these other musicians are there right now. I think it was like Hanukkah was there and Natalie Haas was just moving. Or there was a scene there. And then the year I moved happened to be the year that just like the entire, it just, that was the year it felt like that everybody moved.
Was it 2007?
Yeah.
2008?
2007.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the year I moved away Boston.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Did you move in September of 2007?
Yeah. Is that when you moved away?
I moved in May.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I moved in May of 2007, so ships in the night.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, actually, I wondered why I'd never met you until I met you at Miles of Music. I don't think I had met you in person. I remember Dietrich talking about you for years, and I was like, how come I've not met this Cindy? that year I came, it was bonkers. And then from over those 4 years, it was such an incredible time. And again, it was just all about, for me, I loved Berkeley. Like it had its moments where I was like, oh God, I don't want to do this. But I really loved it. Like,
yeah.
And it was never, yeah, I don't want to do this. It was just more like, oh, can I bother doing this paper? Cause I'm here to play music and I'm not really so into writing a paper on whatever, you know?
Oh yeah.
But
that resonates with me I went to Emerson down the street from Berkeley, mm-hmm, and all I wanted to do was go to the radio station to like, you know, do work or like interview people or like watch people be interviewed. And I remember one time this like professor who I always got an A in his class, 1 year I took an 8 a.m. class from him, which was really early for Emerson kids. And I went to the radio station so many times because the show that I worked on was in the morning. So like, you know, musicians would be stopping by and I would skip his class to go to the radio station. Mm. So instead of giving me an A, he gave me a B. And he was like, I would have given you an A, but you just never came to class. And I was like, well, that's fine.
You're like, look at me now. Look at me now, sir.
Yeah.
Have I hold you that over his to head. Basic folk?
No, he's the best. Maurice Matheau. He's still at Emerson.
Oh, legend.
Total legend. So you eventually made your way to Brooklyn. Oh, is there anything else that you wanted to say about Berkeley times?
Oh, no, just that. I mean, it was, for me, I met so many people, played so much music. Like there was this apartment on Hemingway Street that we, like, it was Dominic Leslie, the mandolin player's place. And we just, I mean, the house would shake, like, with the amount of players that were in that house. Like, they lived on the top floor. And at times, I'm sure there were about, I don't know, at least, like 25 musicians in a circle playing tunes, and we would just be jumping up and down. I mean, it was, I'm sure there's been so many people that have been on your show that were in that house. Like we've had,
there was a circle.
Everyone was there, and it was so amazing. And there, and also just like serious bonding. Like, I mean, I feel so cradled by that world. Like, and moving down to New York from there, it was kind of a no-brainer for me. I was like, I wasn't too keen on moving out west to LA. I think it was kind of like LA or Nashville or New York were the main places that folk went from mm-hmm. school, or, you know, North Portland, or, but I knew I wanted to live in a big, big city for a bit at least. And had community right away. And it wasn't just in the string world. Like I did all sorts of stuff in the world music scene. And, you know, I had a lot of people all across the board. And yeah, just moved down right away in that August, and was straight into living in a house with four girls and four boyfriends, and in this tiny place that I walked past actually recently. Oh, and we were like, what were we doing? Like it was honestly the worst apartment I've ever seen. I mean, I can't believe it, but there were so many amazing musicians lived in that house over the course of the 4 years. It was so epic. Yeah.
When you moved to New York and set yourself up, it sounds like you had a lot of friends that, because I think there's like, there can be a really natural migration for musicians in Boston to make their way to New York eventually. So when did you, can you talk about when it finally felt like your town?
So when I first got there, I was basically taking every gig that came my way, and which meant leaving loads. And I was just like, I want to, at that point, I was like, I just want to be known as a New York-based fiddle player and singer. Mm. I really want that. Like, I really, really want that. And I was just never around and never in New York. So I was never asked to do stuff that was like in the city. I like was desperate for a regular gig in the city, you know? I was like, mm-hmm. at that time, I was just like, I want to play at Sunny's every Tuesday. Or like, I just wanted to have a regular thing. And I didn't have that for a while. And then I was just like, right, well, the only way I'm going to really be able to make money and live here is if I do something additional to playing shows. So I actually became a music nanny in Manhattan and I was on and off doing that job for like 6 years. So I would do like music basically with this family that were just super into that. And it meant that like I would work the afternoons at their house. I didn't live with them. I still lived in my apartment, but I would go up a few afternoons a week, be up there with them. I was like teaching and doing stuff in the morning, and that at night I was playing shows basically every single night of the week in New York, and then going away at the weekends. But I was like very present in the week, and then I'm doing this in the afternoon and just like running around the city and like teaching on the east side, teaching on the west side, rehearsal and wherever, and Brooklyn. Like I felt like this is New York. At that point, I just felt, I was like, what, 26. I had so much energy and I was like, this is the best. Honestly, there's no way I could do that now. There's absolutely no way. there's no way. But I look back at being, 25 and like running around and playing shows every night in the city, and it was so amazing. It was such a special time that like I was exhausted. I was absolutely exhausted, but I felt like I was like part of the YMCA. I was like swimming every morning. I was thriving for this community, and I had it like right at the tip of my fingers, and it was amazing. It was really, when that clicked in, I remember that so distinctly actually.
From interacting with you and listening to your music, I really feel like you, and I want to know what you feel about this, but it feels like you have like a really high emotional intelligence, and that's able to like translate into your music really well. Like you're able to capture a mood like incredibly well. Like you're energetic, you're the life of the party, and then in the next moment you can be reverent and create like a quiet vibe, you know. Mm. Like you seem like somebody that like we can, you know, we can laugh and have a really wild time, but then we can actually like sit down and have a heart to heart. So how do you ride that line in your music between like high, high energy and then sort of like a more solemn vibe?
Wow. That's really nice to hear you say, actually. Thank you. Let's just say I don't write too many hippity happy, happy songs. I write a lot of happy fiddle tunes. I feel like I channel all my like happy, like really like I get all my like fun energy out playing tunes. Like I'm constantly described as like fierce and fun. Like, because I just, I
feisty.
Feisty. Oh my gosh. Like totally. I know, like actually quick tangent on that. I was just doing shows with Laura Cortese again. Laura,
the best.
The best. She's amazing. We were in Belgium in March in this other fiddle player called Begonia, who is from northern Spain. And the three of us, like on stage, we were just these three of like proper feisty, like, I mean, the number of times people came up after and were like, fierce ladies. And I know people describe me as that. I know that people describe Laura as that. And I know people describe Begonia. And the three of us together, it felt so powerful and amazing. There's no like light, like maybe we could have like eased off a little bit, but we're all just like, and here we go. So anyway, the point is, I love like getting really stuck into fiddle tunes. And I love playing slow fiddle tunes, but if I'm playing them, like I like to put, I feel like I throw all my emotion into it. Everything I do when I'm when I'm playing, I rarely will play, and that's actually an interesting thing, because I feel like if I've been playing with people and I haven't felt like I've really been in it, afterwards I have a bit of a moment. I'm like, what was going on there? Like, I am ridiculously in touch with my emotions. I think that is safe to say. I definitely write in my diary every morning and like talk about everything and like I'm hopefully not too much of an oversharer, but I'm like, I just like, my emotions are here. They're like right in front of me. They're there. They're not, there's no, I've worked, there's so much has happened in my life that I've like emotional stuff that I've just learned to like, it's high up. It's not like, I don't bury stuff, which I'm grateful for. I don't know where is that's come from, but I am grateful that that's what it is. I mean, maybe it comes out in, I guess it comes out in my fiddle playing.
Sure.
And singing, like, and my songs, like I struggle to write. I'm like, I would say I am a happy person, but I really struggle to write super happy songs, uplifting, like, I really, really do. And it's such a cliche, but I really do. Like I keep trying. I've made this pact with myself. I'm not going to make a pandemic record that's all about but those are the songs that are coming out. So it probably will, like at the end of next year.
Sure.
You'll be hearing it. But I,
oh my gosh, you've had a lot to process though. That's pretty heavy.
Yeah, and those songs have been written, and I'm sure they'll keep getting written, to be honest. There's stuff that was coming up this morning that I was writing about, and it's just, yeah, but I almost feel like that's too soon to get out, put out into the world, that all of that stuff. But I think maybe writing some more upbeat stuff would, and so I just like share the vibe a little bit more with the fiddle. I gravitate towards, I've just been really in the waltz game recently. All these waltz.
Oh, yeah, the waltz game.
Oh, God, the waltz game. I mean, I'll be like, this is a nice idea. And I'm like, it's a waltz again. I'm going to break the waltz mold.
That's funny. Okay, Hannah, let's talk politics.
Oh, gosh.
So back in 2017, you were part of the supergroup Songs of Separation. You contributed fiddle, guitar, vocals. So this was a project created in the aftermath of the 2014 Scottish independence
referendum.
Referendum. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is, first of all, and then I'll ask my actual question.
So the referendum was when the Scottish this specific one was when Scotland was trying to become, or many people in Scotland were trying to become, to make it an independent country from England. And it it did not go through, as I'm sure you are aware, and it remained as one. But there was this project called Songs of Separation stemmed from that. And it was because there was a significant amount of turmoil between both countries at that time. This musician called Jenny Hill, a bass player, she's an English bass player, came up with the idea of bringing together five Scottish women and five English women, and all of us coming together and making a record called Songs of Separation. The band was called Songs of Separation. The album that we made was called Songs of Separation, but it ended up more being a project of togetherness. So, and it was basically the idea, and it was, we actually recorded on the Isle of Egg. So we were back up on the Isle of Egg, and we had a week to write and record a full album with 10 women and an engineer. And it was some job. I mean, I think it's incredible. I look back at that and I'm like, how on earth did we do that? With like full arrangements. And everybody came with some sort of an idea, whether it was a fully formed idea or just an idea they wanted to develop over the week. There was this amazing song called Soil and Soul, which was written by Rowan Rangans, who is one of the women in the group, who's an incredible musician from Sheffield. Her and I have actually, we've made some recordings since that. We've done a lot of music together off the back of that. But she was one of the ones who brought this soul, which Soil and Soul is the song, if anybody wants to hear, a really beautiful song that was written about a book. I think the book is called Soil and Soul, and it's about the history of the island of Egg, where there was a lot of issues with separation and a lot has been resolved on Egg now, but there was a lot of an intense history on the island. There's actually a 60-minute special if anybody wanted to just get a, they came up to Egg.
I definitely want to watch that, because I was like, just reading like a little bit about it, and then I was like, I could get seriously lost with like how much like turmoil and pillaging and violence that has happened on that little island.
Right. Kinda so nuts. Much has happened. But yeah,
that's like over the course of the last 2,000 years.
Totally. I mean, it's a lot. The island is incredible what's happened up there. But the 60-minute special, I mean, that was recorded like over 10 years ago, and it's definitely dated, but it's, I watched it the other day with my boyfriend and his granny, and she was loving it.
In Alaska?
In California. I was like, it doesn't quite look like that anymore. Like there's more buildings and, you know, people, you know, it does feel dated. But anyway, it's worth watching. I really recommend it. Anyway, back to this project. Basically, what I brought to the project was a Robert Burns poem that was all about this. It had a separation theme. And the amazing thing about that project was, there were so many amazing things, but some of my idols, female musicians that I really had looked up to my entire life, Corinne Polwart, the Scottish singer-songwriter, who's just incredible, and Eliza Carthy, the English trad princess, were both royalty, I should say.
Yes, definitely.
Martin's daughter. They were a part of it, and they had just been big like icons in my life, and I'd known Corinne for quite a few years, but to get to work together where we're all level playing fields, and it was really, really special. And so we made that album, and the album, we actually won Album of the Year at the BBC Folk Awards in 2017. So that was, it had an amazing life, that project, and we headlined Cambridge Folk Fest and did a lot of really interesting performances and collaborations with other artists. And it was just a difficult project to as you can imagine, 10 women who are used to being the front women in their bands, the front person in their bands, suddenly being in a band as a, not as the front person. It was like, it was a very interesting dynamic to work with. All of us had our thing, you know, it was a fascinating project. And it's been such an important thing for me in my career. And that was where off the back of that was how I ended up signing to the label that I'm on now. And I definitely, it was really, really important. I have a lot of massive, like, I'm just so thankful for them bringing me on for that. It was really cool.
Your new album with Michael Starkey is Cross the Rolling Water, which came out in June of 2022. It's an album of old-time fiddle and banjo duets with Michael, who is an Edinburgh-based banjo player. Mm-hmm. So you met at an Appalachian old-time session in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And as it goes, the moment they first struck up a tune together, there was an immediate meeting of the musical minds. So about Michael, it's said that Michael's mission as a musician is to keep things simple, clear melody lines underpinned by solid, infectious rhythm. Mm. When you guys play together, what does his musicality allow for you to do? Like, I'm wondering, are you able to get like really insane with your fiddling? Do you feel like you're toning it down? Does it allow you to play with dynamics?
I would say all of that. He's a very adaptable musician, not in a, now this is how we're going to play because this is how I want to play kind of way. More like he's just a super sensitive musician, and we just really play with each other. We really play against each other. We will play against each other, and then we'll like, and for like to build tension, and then we'll like dip into these like moments where we're super locked in. It's like, it's a really special collaboration. I really love making music with Michael. And it was, the way we met was playing at this session, and there's not a lot of old time musicians in Scotland. And that was like the November, right before the pandemic. And I met him and I was like, oh, this is cool that Michael lives in Edinburgh. Like, to know that there's always this old time, because he's not on any social media. He doesn't have a, like, he has a tiny little Nokia phone. Like, he's like doing his thing, and he's so legit and so amazing. He's been over and played loads of old time music down the East Coast here, and is like, he's just such a deep musician. And because he also doesn't play with that many people. So we just have this amazing, we've had this amazing opportunity to just get to make so much music together. And I just, yeah, I just love making music with Michael Starkey. He's so great.
It must be annoying to text with him, though.
Oh, we don't text. We can't text. I have to send him an email like, can we, are you free to Zoom? Like, when I'm in the States, we've had it today. I was just like, I need just one little question, but I'm like, I need to speak to you. Can we get on Zoom?
Can't text. That's hilarious.
But he can text. If Michael listens to this, he'll be like, I can text, but he just doesn't have an iPhone or no smartphone. So he's...
You can't send him any pics.
No pics. No. No pics.
No. I saw that you worked with Andy Monahan from Frightened Rabbit on a collaboration called Early June, and this was in 2020. And I just would love to hear more about working with Andy... your connection to Frightened Rabbit, and also your experience with Scott. Mm-hmm.
So the project is actually called Early July. Not to...
Oh, what did I call it? Early June?
I like Early June. I do like Early June.
Early July. I wrote down Early July.
Not to, you know, sit here and correct you, Cindy. Let's get it straight here.
Yeah, so, totally. I need a fact checker.
So Frightened Rabbit, for those of you who do not know, Frightened Rabbit have been one of the most well-known indie rock bands to have ever come out of Scotland. They're an incredible band. And I was a big fan for a while. Sadly, the lead singer, Scott Hutchinson, passed away in May. I think it was 2017? Or
2018.
18, May of 2018, mm-hmm. Yeah. And but I actually never met Scott, and I was not friends with anybody in the band when they were a performing band. I was very aware of them. We had many mutual friends, but we just never crossed paths. Their team were keen for the band to be working with folk and with other writers, and just to be out playing and making music. And I was paired up with Andy for some writing. We were linked up via some emails, and the guys had all been sent my music and I was unaware of this. And Andy was the one that was like, oh, I would be interested in working with Hannah. So we like met up in New York, got on like a house on fire, and we're like, right, let's, and a house on fire is a good thing. and then we just were like, right, why don't we just book out some dates at the beginning of next year? This was 19, and let's go into the studio in Glasgow when I was over in Scotland and see what we came up with. So I went in not really knowing at all what we were going to do, but then we started doing this thing where we would write and record a song a day. So we would like wouldn't leave the studio until the full production of the song was done. And it was just really, it was amazing to co-write with someone from a completely different world. It was like this amazing free feeling of like all my like little like insecurities just went out the window. And it was such a quick fire time in the studio of just like, why don't we try this? Why don't we try this? I'll put down synths. No, you put down synths. No, you sound better on synths. Let's do that. And like, and all these parts were flying around, and it was so exciting. It was like this amazing thing, which I hadn't done in that way. Like I had just made my solo album had just come out the year before, which was much, it was a special experience making that, but it was like it was more of a tailored thing. It was much more tailored, much more thought out what we were doing, the arrangements, that whole thing. And this was like, there are arrangements, but the songs were just like, all right. So that was like,
yeah.
I remember taking the train back to Edinburgh from Glasgow after our first session and being like, oh, my God, that was so amazing. I felt alive, like in a really amazing way. I was like, it was so fun. I was like, it was just really, we were both playing like each other's instruments and it just felt really great. So anyway, over the next 2 years, we made an album and the band is called Early July, and the record is actually going to come out next year. We,
great.
Yeah. And I'm really excited about it. We've just been trying to figure out the best way to do it. We kind of wanted to wait until things had simmered down a little bit, as it seemed like every man and their dog released an album this past year. So we were let's just wait a second. Like, still love these songs. They still feel relevant. They were written pre-pandemic, so they're not about that. They're about other stuff. And let's just like, so it will come out. Yeah, we've not got the date. That's not, we're sorting out a lot of the stuff right now. But so that's been a really fun thing to do. We played one show, which was at Celtic Connections in Glasgow just before the pandemic, and it was amazing. It was so fun, like both of us just like totally going for it on electric guitars, and I was playing a bunch of synth on the record, and like it was just it was so fun. I mean, we had like key bass and bass and drums, but it was like, if we get to play that stuff live, which hopefully we will next year, I'm like very excited about that project.
That's great. I will be there and I will call the band by its correct name.
No, I'll get you to introduce
Early
us.
July.
Early June.
Early June, I mean July. Okay, before I let you go, let's do the lightning round.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Here we go. What was the first song you learned on the guitar?
I would say, because I came pretty late to the guitar, probably was Skinny Love, Bon Iver.
Time capsule. What is your karaoke song? Skinny Love, Bon Iver.
Oh, no. It's it's Kiss Me, Sixpence, None the Richer.
Great.
Classic.
What is your coffee order?
An oat milk cappuccino.
First celebrity crush.
A tie, I would say, probably between Seth in The OC and Leonardo DiCaprio in Romeo and Juliet.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Can't go wrong.
And everyone in that film, actually. Everyone in that film. I mean, oh yes. My goodness.
Who is the nicest musician you've ever met?
God, it's difficult with all your pals being musicians.
I know.
You know, I would actually, the first person that pops into mind, I recently met Kevin Burke, the fiddle player, for the first time. And I just remember being, this was at Celtic Connections in January, and I was like, this guy is so nice. Like, he had time for everybody that he was talking to. And for those of you who don't know, he's such an absolute legend. And he's been on recordings I've been listening to my entire life. And he just was like the most egoless man. And it was really lovely.
Mm. Mm-hmm. What was the first album you bought with your own money?
Well, I think it was probably the Spice Girls. I was a big Spice Girls fan.
Big this is all lining up.
Girl power all the way.
That movie is pretty good. Spice World.
It's a classic. Real.
Very good film. Stuff. Flying or invisibility?
Invisibility.
This is the last one. Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Alaska, Scotland, and India. That's not to sound. Mm-hmm. That's not a brag. That's not a brag. But they are all very, very, very beautiful. Very different. Very different. South coast of India might take the... Yeah, I went there with my dad. It was a cool trip.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for talking to me. This was so fun. You have exceeded my expectations. And congratulations on the new duo album, and looking forward to seeing you again in person.
Thanks. Thanks so much. This has been a right old grand time. Thanks, Cindy.
This episode of Basic Vogue was produced by me, Cindy House. Alex Stanton composes our music. The Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network is where you can find all the episodes of Basic Vogue. You can also search on the SiriusXM app for Basic Vogue and find them all there. You can check them out at our website, basicvogue.com, or wherever you find podcasts. We'll talk to you next time you check it out, which is hopefully next week. But it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot. Bye.